letters sent to one of the president's family members in which Mark Meadows said he was pushing hard for Donald Trump to condemn this. Text messages reflecting Mr. Meadows' private skepticism about some of the wild public statements about allegations of widespread election fraud and compromised voting machines that were put forth by Sidney Powell. Sidney Powell is a lawyer working with Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer. The committee also said it had a number of questions prompted by Mr. Meadows' new book, The Chief's Chief, and cited it as evidence that his refusal to testify was untenable. Mr. Meadows has shown his willingness to talk about issues related to the Select Committee's investigation across a variety of media platforms, anywhere it seems, except to the Select Committee, the panel wrote. The House Committee said it also had questions about why Mr. Meadows had used a personal cell phone, a Signal account, and two personal Gmail accounts to conduct official business, and whether he had properly turned over all records from those accounts to the National Archives. The report comes as the committee is scrutinizing a 38-page PowerPoint document containing plans to overturn Joe Biden's election victory. That document, which Mark Meadows provided to the committee, urged Donald Trump to declare a national emergency, to cling to power, and included an unsupported claim that China and Venezuela had obtained control over the voting infrastructure in a majority of U.S. states. Mark Meadows' lawyer has said he provided the document to the committee because he had received it by email and did nothing with it. Phil Waldron, a retired Army colonel who has promoted false claims of election fraud, said that he had circulated the document among Donald Trump's allies and among lawmakers on Capitol Hill in the days just before the mob violence on 6th of January. Rudolph Giuliani has identified Mr. Waldron as a source of information for his legal campaign. Phil Waldron told the Washington Post that he had visited the White House several times after last year's election and spoken with Mark Meadows maybe 8 to 10 times.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, power. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of power and its impact on the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the word power in the Islamic context, we see that in the Islamic context, when it is said about the power, it means that a person who has the power, he lives with chastity, he lives with love, and the power means not to misuse the power that you have. The power means to use power under the surveillance of the justice, under the surveillance of the love. And the power in the Islamic text is used like when you can use your power to show others, it is where you're defending yourself. In the defense, you need to show your power, or for example, you need to show your power so that the enemies cannot attack you. They should know that you have your own rights, you have the power of defending yourself, and you have the power of eliminating any enemy that will attack you. Therefore, when we talk in Islam about the power, this power means that it's for your defense. So when you show your power, it is to defend yourself from the invasion of the others so that no one can invade your country, your house, your respect. And that's what, when we look at the Islamic text, we found these things under the topic of power. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of power under the context of Islamic teachings. And we see that in the Islamic lifestyle, when we talk about the power, this power does not mean oppressing others. This power does not mean to invade other countries. This power does not mean to misuse your ability or this power that you have. This means that you use your power in order to facilitate other people. We use, in Islamic lifestyle, we use power to facilitate other people, to help the oppressed ones, to help the needy ones, and to protect ourselves. This is what power basically refers in the Islamic lifestyle when we talk about the Islamic lifestyle. So even in many of the narrations, we have the same meaning. And also when we talk about the power in Islam, Islam says not to misuse the power, because if someone uses or if someone misuses the power, then obviously he is not following the true path of Islam. So someone should not use it as a trick. So we do not have the permission of using power or misusing the power. Let's say like this. We do not have the permission of misusing the power in order to show ourselves to the others. Therefore, it is very important. It is very important to follow the righteous path which is set in the Islam. And the ones who are following the Islamic lifestyle, who wants to have the Islamic lifestyle, remember, the power that Allah has given to you, it's a blessing. It is a trust which Allah has given you. So use it under the justice, use it with the justice, with the love, and for the sake of betterment of the society, and not to just something which you have personally or to show off yourself, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The British High Court has overturned a ruling that prevented WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from being extradited to the United States, ruling that he can be sent to the U.S. after Washington gave the court assurances that Assange's well-being would be protected were he extradited to the U.S. In January, the court rejected a previous extradition request on the grounds that moving Assange to the United States and isolating him would put him in danger of suicide. The 50-year-old Australian is wanted in the United States for disclosing confidential military and diplomatic records in 2010, which caused Washington great embarrassment. These documents included classified military and diplomatic information detailing U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, information about civilian deaths and secret U.S. drone strikes in Yemen. In face of American officials' denial, he may face up to 175 years in jail if convicted. After being locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 7 years, Assange was apprehended in 2019. He was not present in court, despite his denials of any wrongdoing. He has been held at London's high-security Belmarsh prison for more than 2.5 years. During his High Court appeal in October, Assange had a stroke. The stress of the ongoing U.S. court case against him, as well as a general decline in his health as he approaches his third Christmas behind bars, is said to have precipitated the stroke. Advocates for press freedom have also voiced alarm over the verdict. Reporters Without Borders is concerned about the repercussions for journalism and press freedom throughout the world. RSF also urged Washington to finally drop its long-running case against the journalist.
The U.S. is basically extraterritorializing its laws. It's saying that even if you don't live in the United States, you don't work in the United States, you're not from the United States, if you publish documents the United States doesn't like, they will come get you. And, you know, you can be threatened with 175 years in jail. And they're trying to make an example out of him to scare other people. That's the point that they're making here. At the same time, I just argue one thing. Ironically, in a sense, although Assange's case is unique, it's not unique in terms of assurances because the United States always does this. It always lies to other countries. It lies to other judges, to other jurisdictions, in order to get people into the U.S. And, you know, whether it's through the courts or by kidnapping and rendition, which we've seen the U.S. do a lot. They just kidnap people overseas and render them they bring them to the United States. One way or another, they will find a way to get people in U.S. jurisdiction because they know once you're there, no one is going to help you, no one is going to do anything. And that's the message they're sending here. It's that other countries need to stay in line. You need to hand over anyone we ask you to hand over, whether it takes 10 years, 15 years, you're going to hand them over. And journalists should be scared of publishing documents the U.S. doesn't like.
It appears that the U.S. is attempting to use Assange as a fear tactic to ensure that comparable information concerning its misdeeds is not revealed again. According to Assange supporters, Washington has been discreetly manipulating events, only revealing itself when it filed an extradition request in 2019. According to them, there were several indications that the U.S. was pursuing vengeance on Assange rather than justice. The U.S.'s claims may have far-reaching ramifications for journalism's future and its capacity to hold governments accountable. The U.S. certainly wants to make sure that such a leak would not happen again. The English courts have now sparked outrage by seemingly giving permission to political persecution. Critics fear that the precedent would mean that any journalist in the UK or other parts of the world may now be brought to the US for punishment if they cause Washington sufficient embarrassment.
I think that the US is using its judicial overreach as a way to intimidate people, including journalists, including diplomats, including economic leaders of countries which are not in their favor.
The issue is that if Assange can be imprisoned for performing journalism, why can't the editors of other papers? This is undoubtedly a significant setback for journalistic freedom. On Friday, a bipartisan group of leading members of the U.S. House Committee on Foreign Affairs passed a bill aimed at restricting Iran's defensive military prowess. The Stop Iranian Drones Act would ban the supply, sale, or transfer of military drones to or from Iran under U.S. law. The bill addresses what the U.S. claims to be the growing threat of Iran's unmanned aerial vehicle program. However, despite gaining self-sufficiency in the arms industry by making great progress in developing and manufacturing a broad range of military equipment in recent years, Iran has time and again proven that its military capabilities are purely defensive in the face of moves by the U.S. and its regional allies, which have been fomenting chaos and tension in the region. Like last month, when the Iranian army intercepted two U.S. unmanned aerial vehicles that had penetrated the country's airspace, giving them a stern warning to stay away from the zone where it was holding massive drills. The ban imposed on the Iranian military drones comes amid ongoing talks over the removal of anti-Iran sanctions between Tehran and the signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. The U.S. has for long tried to tie Iran's military capabilities to the talks. However, the Islamic Republic has repeatedly underscored that its defensive capabilities will be never subject to negotiations. The U.S. also baselessly accuses Iran of conducting drone attacks in West Asia, while Washington has blood on its hands for killing thousands of innocent civilians by conducting drone and airstrikes in the region. Also, let's not forget that the United States is the leading exporter of arms in the world. Washington attempts to restrict Iran's defensive capabilities while it sells bombs, drones, and arms to other countries like Saudi Arabia that use them in unjust wars like the one in Yemen to kill innocent civilians. In fact, half of U.S. arms transfers between 2016 and 2020 went to West Asia region, particularly Saudi Arabia, leading to more instability and chaos. The U.S. is also guilty of civilian killings in many war theaters, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, from drone strikes to other military action. Rights groups have accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them. Based on the U.S. military's own assertion, Washington has conducted almost 100,000 drone and air strikes in the West Asia region in the past 20 years, according to a new analysis published by the civilian harm monitoring group Air Wars. The U.S. strikes have killed at least 22,000 civilians across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan since 2001. The group says the number could probably be as high as 48,000. The U.S. also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis in a drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. The two were iconic figures in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group, that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's while top U.S. diplomats have previously admitted that Washington is responsible for the foundation of the Daesh terrorist group. Days after the Brazen Act, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched a volley of missiles at a major military base housing American forces in Iraq. Iran denounced the assassination as a state terrorism and vowed to end the American presence in the region as the ultimate act of revenge.
Well, clearly, if one was going to have a completely honest and neutral legal international legal system, no country can stand above it. But we don't have that. And in fact, we have a system where the people who've got the arms and the money make the decisions. So obviously, if we were to say that any time a country used a drone and killed other civilians, there was going to be sanctions, clearly those countries that have drones, in particular this country, would have to be sanctioned. But that's simply not going to happen.
Political dynamics in West Asia have been undergoing an overhaul since earlier this year when U.S. President Joe Biden announced his country will withdraw its troops from Afghanistan following 20 years of war, and Washington's Western allies followed suit. Just this week, U.S.-led forces ended their combat mission in Iraq, switching to advisory roles in the country. The departure of foreign troops comes amid growing anti-West sentiments in the region and a shift in the focus of Washington's foreign policy from West Asia to China and Russia. That has brought the regional countries together to address the challenges facing the region. One instance is Qatar, which had been under a blockade by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates since June 2017. That went on until January this year, when the quartet agreed to end the diplomatic row. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia and Egypt have appointed new ambassadors to Qatar. Trade and travel links have also been re-established with Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Egypt, but not with Bahrain.
He has noticed that this American support is limited to just maintaining Saudi Arabia as an outpost of military, of U.S. imperial projection and power play in the region. And of course, when this U.S. support were to be removed or to be reduced, Saudi Arabia, as well as the UAE, as well as Bahrain, as Qatar and Kuwait, they need more pillars to work with. They need more legs to stand on. And one of the best things to do in this region is collaborate and cooperate with the governments already exist and try to bridge the differences that might exist between various countries.
Qatar's emir has traveled to Saudi Arabia and met Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman several times since then. On Wednesday, bin Salman made his first official visit to Qatar since he was named Crown Prince in 2017. A senior official at the Iranian Foreign Ministry says the development of ties and cooperation with the neighboring countries is among the priorities of the new administration in Tehran. Alireza Inayati says trips and negotiations by the Iranian officials in recent months are all proof of that policy. He says Iran has good ties with the Persian Gulf Arab states, including the UAE, Oman, and Kuwait. Inayati heads the Iranian Foreign Ministry's Office for Persian Gulf Affairs. He was speaking with the Iranian Arabic news channel Al Alam. Inayati also said Iran and Saudi Arabia have held four rounds of talks since September to mend their ties and plan more negotiations. He cited progress in the talks, saying they were friendly and constructive. Ties severed between Tehran and Riyadh in 2016. The two have differences on some regional issues, including the Yemen war. For years, the kingdom pursued a confrontational foreign policy toward the Islamic Republic, but it has recently appeared to have changed track.
When it comes down to it, they are two nations that border the Arab Gulf. They are two nations that are in a very strategic area to border the Gulf region, border the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz. So these all areas that are of a vitally strategic importance. And when push comes to shove, it is them who have to live there, not the United States, not the United Kingdom, or the European Union, or any of these Western powers. It is the Iranians, it is the Arabs, the Saudis, the Iraqis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris who have to live in this region, have to find a way to keep on living. This is something that I believe a couple of years ago that the Iranian government already said, and when it comes down to it, this should be a regional decision.
The recent developments in the region signal a paradigm shift in the ties between West Asian countries. The jury is still out on what that would mean for the United States' interests and influence in the region.
Germany has a new chancellor. Social Democrat Olaf Scholz has been sworn in as Germany's new chancellor, ending 16 years of conservative rule under Angela Merkel. Scholz, who is now 63, had served as vice chancellor and finance minister in Merkel's outgoing government. He got 395 votes from lawmakers in the lower house of parliament. Scholz will oversee a liberal-left coalition government between the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, the Greens, and the Liberal Free Democratic Party, or the FDP. This is the first power-sharing agreement of such a kind in Germany, and the first governing alliance with three parties since 1957. Merkel's final days as chancellor was her 5,860th day in office, falling short of the record set by her late former mentor, Helmut Kohl, by a mere 10 days.
Well, the positive is that she actually kept the German economy strong. Germany is still an export powerhouse. There are signs of a certain weakening, but still its position is very strong. She left very popular, which is very important. Clearly, Germans liked her steady, somewhat conservative leadership, and she certainly established Germany as the preeminent power in the European Union.
The alliance brings to a close 16 years of rule by Angela Merkel, who chose not to run again. Germany's incoming government has agreed that EU authorities should act more urgently to defend the rule of law, including withholding EU funds if necessary.
I mean, the pressures that are pulling apart the EU are growing. After Brexit, people became frightened and decided, you know, that maybe leaving the EU was not such a great idea. But now these centrifugal forces are reasserting themselves. The EU is torn between East and West, North and South, but the East European countries are pushing a much more confrontational policy vis-a-vis Russia. They're allying themselves with the United States, and France and Germany are caught in the middle. And they're kind of trapped, and they aren't sure what to do.
The new government has ambitious plans to fight climate change by phasing out coal early and focusing on renewable energy. But their initial priority will be tackling the coronavirus pandemic. Angela Merkel served alongside four U.S. presidents, four French presidents, five British prime ministers, and eight Italian premiers. Her chancellorship was marked by four major challenges: the global financial crisis, Europe's debt crisis, the 2015-16 influx of refugees to Europe, and the coronavirus pandemic. While credited with securing huge European bailouts that saved Greece from crashing out of the Eurozone, it was achieved at a heavy social cost. Merkel was highly unpopular for being the driving force behind bailouts and austerity cuts. The policy made millions of people jobless, plunging them into poverty. Merkel also kept Germany's borders open to hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing the wars in Syria and Iraq. But the policy drew criticism from right-wing politicians. The refugee influx gave a good excuse to far-right groups to fan the flames of Islamophobia. Popular anger also sent the far-right bloc, the anti-immigration AfD, to parliament in 2017 for the first time since World War II, making it the biggest opposition force. Merkel's government was accused of protecting Germany's vital automobile industry by watering down emissions regulation reforms, and its refusal to advance the 2038 deadline to quit coal energy, also irking green activists.
And she's been caught in the middle of a lot of conflicts and has not acquitted herself especially well. And that includes the Ukraine and Iran, especially the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord. Germany under Merkel mostly towed the U.S. line and did not get very many rewards for it. They lost business opportunities in Iran, and they have been kind of chained to an increasingly erratic U.S. policy.
Her government also did not play a constructive role after the nuclear deal with Iran in 2015. Germany under Merkel practically followed the maximum pressure campaign of the U.S. against Iran and did not fulfill its obligations under the deal.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. Allahumma wa as'aluka su'ala man ishtaddat faqatu wa anzala bika 'inda ash-shada'id hajata wa 'azma fi ma 'indaka raghbata Allahumma Brothers and sisters, in the next part, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this divine supplication, states, وَأَنْزَلَ بِكَ عِنْدَ الشَّدَائِدِ حَاجَتَ. I ask you, O Allah, with the asking of the one who has stated to you in difficulties his need. The merciful obviously knows all about his servants' needs and wants, and he is completely aware of the stations and the positions and everything he runs into, because he is the creator, he is the one who is absolute cause, and he is completely aware of the difficulties the servant is running into. He can fulfill the needs or remove the difficulties for him, but he subhanahu wa ta'ala wishes for his servant, based on the different Quranic verses, to state his needs, pray to him, to worship him, so that Allah solves his problems and difficulties. When the servant turns his face towards him, it is the time that the Almighty Allah eliminates calamities, saves him from misfortunes. Then he would fulfill his servant's demand out of mercy, loading him with blessings. It is Almighty Allah's desire for his servant to state his needs, which is in fact a form of worship and complete obedience to him. Isn't it the case that Almighty Allah has ordered his servants to pray and has guaranteed fulfilling it? Ud'uni astajib lakum, call on me and I will answer you. Praying, supplicating, and stating the wants are not only one form of worshipping and obeying the Almighty Allah, but they are in fact the core of worship, as we have previously discussed. Allah does not wish his servant to turn to sources other than him in case of difficulties and calamities. The servants cannot refer to others and ask their needs from them or request the solution of the problem from other than the Almighty Allah.
Oh Allah, I beg as one whose neediness is extreme, and who supplicates his knees to you, and whose desire for that which is with you has become great. O Allah, great is your kingdom, and exalted is your greatness. Your plan is secret, your authority is manifest, your might is victorious and subduing, and your power is prevalent throughout, and it is not possible to escape from your dominion. O Allah, apart from you, I do not find anyone able to pardon my sins, nor to conceal my shameful acts, nor do I have anyone except you to change my evil deeds into virtues. There is no God but you, glory and praise be to you. I have oppressed my own soul, I had the audacity to sin by my ignorance. I have relied upon my ancient remembrance of you and your grace towards me. O Allah, my Lord, how many of my ugly deeds have you concealed? How many of my grievous afflictions have you abolished? And how many stumblings of mine have you prevented? How many of my detestable acts have you averted? And how many of my undeserving praises have you spread abroad? Thank you, Allah,
now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
In a divine tradition narrated in various lofty books, important issues and valuable facts are stated in this regard. For example, in the book titled As Anisul Layl, we read, أَيَأْمُ الْعَبْدِ فِي الشَّدَائِدِ غَيْرِي وَالشَّدَائِدُ بِيَدِي وَيَرْجُو سِوَايِ. Is my servant hopeful of those other than me when facing difficulties to resolve them for him, while eliminating all the problems is in my hands? Is my servant hopeful of the others but me to fulfill his needs and wants and save him from poverty, while the generous and the beneficent is me, and accomplishing all the exigencies is in my power and mercy? فَمَا لِي أَرَى عَبْدِي مُعْرِضًا عَنِّي وَقَدْ أَعْطَيْتُهُ بِجُودِي وَكَرَمِي مَا لَمْ يَسْأَلْنِي. Why is it that I see my servant ignorant of me, while I have always granted him everything he wanted, out of mercy, even the things he did not ask for? فَأَعْرَضَ عَنِّي وَسَأَلَ فِي حَوَائِجِهِ غَيْرِي وَأَنَا اللَّهُ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا أَنَا. Why has he turned from me? Why has he referred to others now when he is so much in need? I am the deity except whom there is no other deity. I grant without demand. Would I not grant if I am demanded? أَبْتَدِئُ بِالْعَطِيَّةِ مِنْ غَيْرِ مَسْأَلَةِ أَفَأُسْأَلُ فَلَا أَجُودُ أَلَيْسَ الْجُودُ وَالْكَرَمُ لِي. Is the vast ocean of mercy and generosity not from me? أَلَيْسَ الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةُ بِيَدِي. Are the world and the hereafter not in my hands? If all the things in the heavens and the earth ask me to grant them demands as big as all the heavens and the earth, my kingdom would not be reduced even to the extent of a fly. فَلَوْ أَنَّ كُلَّ أَهْلِ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ سَأَلَنِي مِثْلَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَأَعْطَيْتُهُ.
ما نقص ذلك من ملكي جناح بعوضة. And at the end, this beautiful divine tradition ends saying, فيا بؤسا لمن أعرض عني وسأل في حوائجه وشدائده غيري. And woe to the one who turns attention from me, demanding his needs from those except me. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Scientists in Brazil have come up with a creative way to shore up the population of a majestic species of monkeys in danger of extinction. Brazilian conservationists have constructed a bridge to reconnect the two sides of Rio de Janeiro's Atlantic forest. The road had effectively isolated a group of lion tamarins, but now it offers hope for the endangered monkey. There are only 2,500 golden tamarins left in the wild, all of them in Brazil. It is estimated that these animals have lost more than 95% of their habitat.
As people around the globe are preparing for the New Year holidays, the Vatican lights up the Christmas tree and nativity scene set up on St. Peter's Square. People gathered around the square waiting for long hours to see the illumination. Even heavy rain did not stop them. That's why the official lighting ceremony was held inside the Paul VI Hall, where Pope Francis presides his weekly audiences. The nativity scene, made of more than 30 pieces, is created by Peruvian artists. The majestic Christmas tree is about 28 meters and comes from Andalo, northern Italy. The locals see the stunning tree as a symbol of hope and peace. The tree will be switched on every night until January the 6th.
Childhood joy and lightness meet with art at a first-of-its-kind museum in Rome, Italy. Here, all kinds of art decorations are made of balloons. The exhibit dubbed Let's Fly displays a broad range of interactive artworks. In one installation, visitors are invited to find their inner child by diving into a pool of hundreds of small balloons. In another section, giant inflatable sculptures double as a playground for kids. Some installations move only by riding a bicycle. The museum is a place where artists and spectators coexist for a journey into a world of inflatable art capable of freeing the imagination of all ages.
It's the combination of art with childhood and adolescence that makes this place so magical. So they are art installations, but also games. The blurred line between the two is what makes the museum so unique.
The balloon exhibit incorporates innovative works created by 14 different artists from across Europe. The artifacts were created using hundreds of thousands of biodegradable balloons. Organizers say they want to increase environmental awareness by being eco-friendly, as all the artworks will be reused or recycled. The exhibit will run until March the 5th.
Chinese students receive a science lesson on their country's space station, and they are lucky enough to receive it firsthand from the astronauts living in the first and core module of the station. The class was held via a live broadcast shown on the state television. The three astronauts gave a lecture that focused on physics. They explained how the weightlessness environment affects the movement of objects. The astronauts also gave a tour of the station they arrived at in October for a six-month stay. It seems that their teachings were quite motivating. The students peppered their instructors with questions, including those about living conditions in space. China launched its space station in April and plans to complete it by the end of the next year. Christmas is just around the corner, and children are waiting for their presents. In Guatemala, Santa Claus has a new mode of transport to give gifts to children with cancer.
Today, as in the past year, we are celebrating Christmas with the cancer patients of the shelter. Santa Claus came in a helicopter to give presents to the children. It is very emotional for the children. The majority of them have never been so close to a helicopter, let alone Santa Claus.
That was an exciting experience for the children. The charity event was organized by an institute that supports cancer patients for remote areas in Guatemala. The institute says the event aimed to help the children go through their therapies with more ease. The Amazon River turtles are in danger of extinction, but environmentalists have come up with an initiative to save their lives. And that's by protecting their eggs. Climate change and human activities against their ecosystem have been putting these creatures at risk. Now, what the biologists and local volunteers do is that they recover the turtle nests from riverbanks during the rainy season to protect them from drowning. Then they take care of the baby turtles until they develop a hard shell and are ready to start their life journey. Batches of tiny turtles release into a river in the Amazon border between Bolivia and Brazil. They are now grown enough to protect themselves against different threats. Environmentalists have been doing this for more than 20 years, saving millions of baby turtles. This time they released 1 million of the little turtles. During the Christmas season, people around the world love to add a dose of joy in the form of Santas. Children especially feel ecstatic to see Santas distributing presents and snacks. But you'll be amazed to see how one Santa this time dives into water to give well-behaved sharks and fishes their goodies. In Malta's National Aquarium, Scuba Claus, helped by an elf, plunges into a huge fish tank with his sack of treats to feed sharks and fishes. Santas, ho ho ho, come out in bubble from through his snorkel over his white beard. The aquarium, located in the northern part of the island, hosts more than 175 different species of various marine animals.
Butterflies are probably the most popular among all insect species on Earth due to their beauty and color. Millions of monarch butterflies have flocked to a Mexican forest, creating a magical sight, drawing tourists, scientists, and locals there. The monarch butterflies flee the cold winters of Canada and northern United States and travel thousands of kilometers to hibernate and reproduce in the temperate woods of central Mexico. Hundreds of trees crowded with butterflies can be seen along Mexico's 13,000-hectare monarch reserve after their long journey. However, experts warn of a drop in the number of the species. Climate change is reported to have had an impact on their butterflies' migration pattern, as well as a reduction in their milkweed breeding habitat in the United States.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
With the Christmas season in full swing, hundreds have gathered on Spain's Gran Canaria island to watch stunning sand sculptures representing the birth of Christ. 8 sand artists from around the world have created the spectacular figures. It took them a week to complete the scenes. A huge sand wall is built around the sculptures to protect them. The island has been holding the event every year since 2006. The warm temperatures on the Spanish beach have helped attract a lot of visitors over Christmas. According to the organizers, at least 200,000 people have visited the exhibition in the past 15 years. A joyful day at an Australian zoo as a baby pygmy hippo is born. That's good news for the zoo staff because pygmy hippos are endangered species. Cambiri, the mother hippo, gave birth to the calf last month. It's her second calf and the first one was born in a Sydney zoo 4 years ago. The newborn is yet to be named. It sticks to the mum and follows her wherever she goes. The calf is spending most of its time out of the sight of the public, as for now it's learning to walk and swim. And the mum keeps a close eye on the calf at all times.
The first few days, she did not leave the calf's side, was very sedate, very quiet, and just looking after its every need. And only in the last sort of couple of days, as she started to get a little bit more sleep in.
They are regarded as endangered animals because of illegal hunting and loss of habitat. Currently, less than 3,000 pygmy hippos are living in the wild.
Is it interesting to experience what Harry Potter went through at Hogwarts? Well, it could be, at least for students at a university in Pakistan, kicking off a festival celebrating the fictional wizard. The students at Government College University made their 150-year-old campus look like the magical school created by British author J.K. Rowling. They put on costumes and set up decorations reminiscent of Hogwarts. The university's vice chancellor says the campus, with its vast halls and soaring archways, has always reminded the students of the fictional school.
Most of these youngsters, they grew up at the time when J.K. Rowling's work was being presented in the novels and then later on in the film. So that magical charm, that fantasy, they really enjoyed. They grew up reading that fantasy. And then when they come to Government College University and see these architecture, it reminds me of that Hogwarts that is being filmed in Harry Potter films.
The university officials spoke proudly of what his students have done. They were themselves happy too, calling their experience fun. Others said it was unbelievable to be in Hogwarts. The festival also screened Pakistan's first fan-made Harry Potter film made and acted by the students. The
Swedish city of Stockholm has launched its 31st annual Christmas competition of baking gingerbread.
There is a limited in space, so it's 40 centimeters by 40 centimeters, and everything you built, all the material, need to be eatable. So you can build with different things, gingerbread, of course, but also candies and other things, but you need to be able to eat it. So that's one of the rules as well.
Each year, the Gingerbread House competition, hosted by ArcDesk Museum of Architecture and Design, has a theme for the designs. This year's theme is Together, attracting various interpretations of the topic. So far, the entries have included the Titanic, the famous coffee shop from the American TV show Friends, an igloo, and the Berlin Wall, all entirely edible. The event, which has been running for 31 years, is designed for all kinds of creators, such as children, young people, adults, amateurs, and professionals. The Tasty exhibition runs until January the 5th. A Palestinian teacher has developed an assistant for himself nicknamed Mr. Robot, bringing joy to the children of a school in Gaza. Mr. Robot teaches the children of Al-Basma School about electric circuits and helps them memorize their lessons. Mr. Robot moves freely in the classroom, speaking Arabic to students and communicating with them as a friend. The teacher creating it says the aim was to stimulate creativity and innovation in his classroom.
Mr. Robot, as his name suggests, is the teacher's assistant and not his replacement. He assists in the education process by asking questions and giving answers, greeting students and interacting with them in all aspects of a class.
The teacher says at first students reacted to it in a strange way, but later on they said it was like a dream come true for them. Local engineers say the robot is the first of its kind in the Gaza Strip, where electrical tools and components are scarce.
Artificial intelligence has found its way into several aspects of our lives. Now, a French research team is working on a project to provide fishermen with intelligent trawls that could help them sort out fishes before they are brought to the boats.
The objective of the project is to try to provide a support tool for fishermen, because at the moment, when they put their fishing gear in the water, a trawl net is like a large net. It is towed behind the vessel for several hours without having knowledge of what enters the trawl net in real time. Namely, is it species that are targeted by the fishermen or not targeted?
The trawl head has a camera that can capture footage underwater, which is then analyzed by a microcomputer using artificial intelligence. If targeted fishes are detected, the trawl will switch to fishing mode, but when there are no targeted species, it will switch back to flight mode to avoid having an impact on the seabed. Another feature of this technology is to identify and classify pelagic species. For instance, horse mackerel can be displayed in blue on the screen, while the sardines are shown in pink.
IRIB English Radio.